Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our latest Tenneo Insights call. Our health emergency is not yet over, and our economic emergency has just begun. With those words, Rishi Sunak summed up his view of the devastation caused by COVID-19. The Financial Times used one word to describe the economic forecast that went along with the spending review: gruesome. Choose your superlative, the statistics are breathtaking, eye-watering, unprecedented. The economy is 11.3% smaller than at pre-COVID levels. It's estimated it will take till the end of 2022 just to get back to the same levels as 2019. There will need to be between £21 and £46 billion of tax rises or spending cuts to balance the books. Borrowing has risen to £863 billion, debt to £2.7 trillion. In a politically symbolic move, the foreign aid budget was cut by £4 billion, and the money directly transferred to a fund we're told will help build back better, particularly in parts of the UK traditionally considered left behind. Not everyone is so bleak about it all, though. Many economists predicted that all the dry powder that's built up during coronavirus in terms of savings and pent-up demand will explode in a post-vaccine world. So just how bad is it, and what will it mean for business? As ever, we've assembled the perfect panel to discuss all this. Stephanie Flanders is head of Bloomberg Economics and a former BBC Economics editor. She's perfectly placed to give her assessment of where the economy is right now. Sir Anthony Seldon has too many strings to his bow to list, but he's one of our most astute political commentators and has written many biographies of prime ministers. He'll have an invaluable perspective. Deborah Mattinson is a pollster and founding partner of Britain Thinks. She's been tracking public sentiment. And Amber Rudd is a Tenneo senior advisor, former Home Secretary and Secretary of State at the Department of Welfare and Pensions. She'll have an invaluable insight on where the government and economy are going. But before we get to the panel, the usual housekeeping points. Please keep yourself on mute throughout the call. If you drag your cursor to the sidebar of the screen, you can see the chat function. Please send your questions here, and I'll put them to the panel in the second half of the call. And for legal reasons, I have to say, if there are any journalists on the call, please hang up now. This isn't intended for outside broadcast or publication. So let's start with you, Stephanie. You're the economist. The tone has been really gloomy in the last 24 hours, but how downbeat are you? Oh, I think you're on mute, Stephanie. So Joe, who is looking at this, I don't know if you can actually play with her levels. Try again, Stephanie. Okay, we seem to be having a problem there. Why don't we go to another member of the panel just quickly, and then we'll come back to you. Anthony, we were going to come to you second on this. You've got a long view. You've written massively in the past about prime ministers and chancellors. What's your take on the situation? And you need to take yourself off mute too.
Can you hear me?
We can.
So we need a sense of history here, Craig, and welcome everybody. Nice to be here. We are in one of the four biggest crisis points in the 300-year history of prime ministers since Robert Walpole became Britain's first prime minister 299 years ago. Since then, we've had 55 prime ministers, very few of whom have been undisputed successes. Indeed, only eight of 55 have been great prime ministers. And if we compare that to German chancellors since 1945, the strike rate is considerably better for German chancellors, just to take one other country, with Adenauer and Erhard and Schmidt and Brandt and Kohl and Schroeder and Merkel. Not all are great successes, but a far higher record of really dynamic and sustained effectiveness and leadership of their country than Britain has had. And it is tough for Boris Johnson at the moment, and particularly tough because the Conservative Party, as Amber will know, is much more lethal to its leaders than the Labour Party is. So he has, Craig, shall I continue?
Yes, please keep going.
He has not had a good 7 months since COVID started, and he hasn't had a good week last week with not running over it, but the whole Dominic Cummings episode and his indiscretion over Scotland. Yet another careless comment from him, and then Patel, and then the furore over the 0.7% with the resignation yesterday of one of his junior ministers, Liz Doug, perhaps being a harbinger. So he's got to now prove his credibility with three groups, with his Conservative MPs, because they will have him out if he doesn't perform better. They voted for him thinking that he would be a great a campaigner. Well, he proved that with Brexit and with the general election last year, but they were last year, and they were so last year for Conservative MPs who think primarily about their own re-election and their own journeys up a ministerial ladder that will not be there if the Conservatives are not in power. Secondly, he has credibility to establish with his new number 10, post-Cummings, post-Lee Kane, with Allegra Stratton, a very brave and perhaps foolhardy move of having a White House-style a press spokesman on camera taking the job that Craig Oliver no less himself had. But when Craig was there, there was a very steady chief of staff, and Boris Johnson has yet to do that, and he's got to establish credibility with the nation. So just finishing off my slot, and if I'm going to be continuing to the end of the last minute and a half, his three great worries now in his in tray are, first of all, his personal survival. It is far from evident that Boris Johnson is going to be still prime minister this time next year. There are only so many mistakes and inadequacies that a prime minister can have before cabinet ministers, senior officials, the business community become alienated from somebody who is, in their eyes, not capable of doing the job. That stench of the carrion crow vulture stench of death has been hanging like a cloud, hovering above number 10. And if it settles there, he will go. Secondly, Brexit. We have been told that Brexit is going to be marvellous for the economy in the longer term, if not the shorter term. And he is the person who has taken the country into Brexit. If and of course, it's the short term that people are going to, the business and others are going to be looking at most. If the promised land is not materialised, then it will be in deep trouble. And then the economy post COVID that we were hearing about. What is he going to do with this greatest economic crisis in the 300 years of the premiership? And will there be the cash to allow him to do the levelling up, without which he has no credibility as Prime Minister if he doesn't level up, and he won't win in 2024. So finally, Craig, he needs to be, of the 55 Prime Ministers, to get out of this doo-doo, Johnson's going to have to be the ninth of those eight Prime Ministers who have been great, and anything less than greatness will not do the job.
Thank you, Anthony, and thanks for stepping in. Stephanie's here now. Let's see if your sound is working. We were talking about you are there, great. We were talking about the eye-watering sums of money being thrown about and the levels of debt, that kind of thing, and also the levels of gloominess yesterday. Are you as gloomy as the papers were and as Rishi Sunak appeared to be?
Well, you know, obviously he had a tough job, and we knew the numbers were going to be massive. We also knew that he was going to be having to play quite a delicate dance, pairing his effort to still play to sort of old school fiscal conservatism with the enormous ocean of red ink in front of him, and with a lot of Boris's speeches and penchant for grand projet still ringing in people's ears, even from the last week or so. So, We knew that was going to be difficult. I'm always imposed a bit of a global perspective on these calls, for which I don't apologise. But I think just to set the scene, if one was looking at it from the rest of the world with the sort of economic lens that we have sitting in Bloomberg Economics, The world is actually looking now at potentially a relatively upbeat scenario for next year for coming out of this. It depends on some pretty big things. It depends on this second wave of the virus, managing to flatten the curve, an efficient rollout of vaccine in most of the major economies in the first half of next year, fiscal stimulus in the US being maintained, and more broadly expansionary policy being maintained, and the rumours of the death of globalisation turning out to have been exaggerated. I would say all of those things are quite possible. But we UK are counting not just on those things, but Brexit going smoothly. And we're starting, I've mentioned this on these calls before, we are starting from a place that is markedly worse than our partners across the channel and indeed the US. If you look at the daily activity indicators that we look at and where our GDP is now relative to the start of the year, we are significantly worse than France, Germany, the US, most of these trading partners. And it's not entirely clear why. We sort of flattened out in terms of activity sooner than others, and we now seem to be struggling. We seem to be having just as much of an impact from a second wave, in fact, more from this second lockdown. Anyway, so he's coming in with that perspective. I think relative to expectations, we knew those numbers were going to be bad. I was very struck that he did still make the effort to take £10 billion out of the future spending plans outside of there's the additional COVID spending of about 50 billion or so, 55 billion for next year. But embedded in this, which includes the development aid cut, he's found about 10 billion, which goes forward. So the typical department that we're talking about for this kind of spending in a few years' time is going to be about £13 billion lighter than they thought a few months ago. That is not insignificant. It's not going to do the whole job, but I think it's striking that he chose to do that. In terms of the ways that he tried to play to the more sort of Boris, you might say, sort of the new Tory agenda of levelling up and other things, the unemployment money, I would say, was the few billion for the unemployed was welcome. Maybe will make a contribution to reducing the long-term scarring from this, which is so crucial for the public finances as well. I thought the levelling up fund was a bit fake. It's real money in a sense, but it's not remotely in line with the kind of George Osborne agenda of giving genuine power over a bit more money to those local areas. So I was a bit, I thought that was a sort of very, very gimmicky. I think that the not maintaining the extra benefit, the extra £10 a week, I suspect he'll end up having to reverse that. So it's supposed to be going away in March. I suspect we'll get all the numbers about who's going to be affected and how unfair it is, and he'll have to reverse that. So big picture, I think there was a bit of a certain lack of realism about the politics of those future spending constraint that he's going to be able to do. And he conspicuously failed to start signalling tax rises as part of the future. And I think I'm nervous about that, because he sounded relatively more hawkish on the fiscal side than I might have expected. Certainly more hawkish than many other finance ministers at the moment. You've got the International Monetary Fund. You've got everyone saying now is not the time to tighten. It's quite striking that he's laying that territory and actually finding some cuts already. And I think, as I say, it's disappointing that in starting to pave the way for that, he didn't make a point of saying we're not going to be able to do this the way we did it last time. And that is that the overwhelming consensus of anyone looking at this is you will not have the kind of 80-20 balance we had with austerity, where you found, when you're looking at the deficit cuts, it didn't quite work out this way, but the original plan in 2010 was to have 80% of the deficit reduction through spending cuts and 20% through tax rises. Many people think a realistic assessment is it would almost be the reverse this time around. And although you can debate about the ratio, certainly that there should be a lot more from tax rises. No effort to pave the way for that or make any difficult decisions now, even if they're set long-term into the future. But still taking the risk, I would say, with the rhetoric and with the spending cuts that were announced, spending squeeze, I should say, that you will end up in the wrong place, that you'll end up trying to tighten sooner than you should. And given the weak position that we're in, I think it would be particularly risky for us to be tightening too quickly or sending some kind of signal to the markets that we're going to be ahead of other countries on that. So I'll leave it there, but I think there's plenty to discuss.
Thanks, Stephanie. That was fascinating. Deborah, I'm going to come to you next. We've had you on this call a number of times, and you've been tracking public opinion over the last few months. Where are they with this sense, the growing sense of economic difficulty and the fact that, you know, the restrictions are still remaining?
So we repeated our annual Mood of the Nation study back at the end of September, and it showed a gloomier nation than I've seen literally in decades of monitoring it. So three quarters of us feel pessimistic or very pessimistic about the country, and that is up 10% last year, where I was also saying this is the gloomiest I've ever seen people. We're pessimistic about the country, about our local communities, and about our own personal lives. And I think another thing to say that's quite interesting is there's a sort of inequality of gloom. So if you are young, if you're working class, if you're a Labour voter, and if you're a woman, you are significantly more likely to feel gloomy than if you are none of those things. So, and what we're seeing here, and we've been seeing it all the way through the pandemic, we saw it yesterday, is this sort of struggle of the government to balance fears for health and gloominess about health outcomes with fears for the economy and gloominess about the economic outcomes. And throughout this whole time, what we've seen is that health has won that battle with the public, and it still is. They are typically much more hawkish about lockdown, even given the vaccine now on the horizon. But that doesn't mean they're not worried about the economy. They are very worried about the economy, and they are increasingly worried about the economy. And I think they will be even more so given the figures that were set out yesterday. So 9 out of 10 of us think that the cost of living will go up. And 8 out of 10, when you ask who's going to pay the price for that, think they will. So we think that ordinary people, we are going to be the people who pay the price. So where does all this take? So this is in part about leadership. And, you know, Anthony has already mentioned this. Only a third think that the government is handling the crisis well. Labour, from a deficit of 20-odd points, has drawn level in the polls. And in some polling, at least, Keir Starmer is now the preferred prime minister. Although, and I'll come back to this, I think the government is still holding up quite well in those really crucial battleground red wall seats. I spent a lot of time thinking about them this year because I've written a book about the red wall, and I interviewed people at the beginning of the year. I went back to some of the people who had been big Boris fans in the autumn and said, how do you feel now? And they said they were disappointed. They were very disappointed. One person said to me, we voted for bold and we ended up with waffle. And against that backdrop, our leadership study shows that being decisive and being a strong communicator matters as much as it ever has. And people feel he's falling short on those things. But having empathy also matters much more than it has done in the past in this crisis. So we've repeated our annual survey on leadership in September. And we looked at whose leadership people value from a very long list, which included historical figures, international figures, current figures. The top, as always, he's always top, is Winston Churchill. Of current leaders, Jacinda Ardern tops the list. Of British leaders, Nicola Sturgeon tops the list. And anecdotally, in our focus groups, she is really, really impressing people, including people south of the border. That's quite interesting. Donald Trump came last by quite some measure. And interestingly, a new arrival is Marcus Rashford, whose leadership is hugely admired. And he scored higher than the Queen and higher than most politicians as well. So in the focus groups that we did that accompanied that, we did our old favourite game of, you know, if this politician was an animal, what animal would they be? And this is quite revealing. Boris Johnson is a sheep. So he's being chased around a field by public opinion, then by science, then by his own backbenchers, with no really powerful sense of direction. Keir Starmer is a mighty eagle. Now, at first sight, this seems a really good thing to be. Who wouldn't want to be an eagle? But what they then said is he's circling above it all. He's looking down on the situation and analysing everything. And there is this, I think, potentially quite fatal sense of being distanced from what's going on. So finally, then, you know, how will yesterday have landed? Will it have made any difference? And here, actually, I do disagree with Anthony in his assessment of where the Tories are and where this government is, because I wonder if the last week or so, culminating potentially yesterday, is a bit of a turning point that might halt Labour's advance. And I would see Dominic Cummings going actually as a good thing, and something that might you know, be a positive, have a positive impact on the government. So Sunak is a strong performer. Of all of the members of this government, he is by a mile the most popular. And yesterday won't have done anything to dislodge him. And I think you also have to remember that Labour have always, well, always apart from a brief joyous period in government, have trailed the Conservatives on management of the economy. And everything that's going on at the moment poses massive challenges for them. My guess is that the Tories are on the right side of the argument on the two most contentious issues, public sector pay freezes and cutting overseas aid. And I say the right side of the argument, by the way, just for clarity, I don't mean, i.e. agreeing with me, I mean agreeing with the public and swing voters. So public sector pay freeze, I think, will just about be okay. And I can talk in more detail about why I think so, but principally because the NHS is excluded from that. Cutting overseas aid, I think, will play very well with red wall voters. What we know is that nationally, 66% now support cutting overseas aid, but those figures are going to be much higher in those red wall seats, who are frankly furious about it and believe that charity should begin at home in their own beleaguered communities. And what I think about this, perhaps I'll end it here, but happy to come back to any of these points. I think that overseas aid and the row that's developing about it is actually very helpful for the government. It's seen in those seats as a sort of symbolic policy. They don't think about it very much, but when they do, it says something about the values that they espouse and whether or not the government shares them. And I think they will feel the government is in tune with them on that. That's what I leave it
there. There's a huge amount in there. That's absolutely fascinating. I'm glad to see that Anthony didn't walk out when you disagreed with him. He just went.
I thought he was there. He got up, didn't he? I felt a bit worried.
But anyway, let's come. Just a reminder that Q&A function, do put your questions in there. Some are already coming through. But Amber, I'm just going to come to you now. You've been quite prescriptive, I think, in terms of what you think the government should do, particularly in terms of like the infrastructure and green jobs and that kind of thing. They haven't really put very much flesh on the bones of that kind of thing. What do you make of that? And more broadly, what did you make of the spending review yesterday?
Yes, I'm surprised that Rishi didn't go in more into the theme of a green agenda for this government. I mean, since this government took over, they've been looking really for a theme. What is Johnsonianism? What is the purpose? Which lane are they trying to drive in? And over the past few months, I thought that they'd got it, which was the whole green agenda in terms of not just addressing dangerous climate change, but using it as a springboard to create more jobs in the northern seats. The whole levelling up agenda plays into it. It's a gift in terms of demonstrating global Britain next year with COP26. And finally, with Joe Biden becoming president, it's an opportunity for a closer working relationship with the US when we hold the chair of COP26. So for the past few months, with Boris driving that agenda, making these very positive announcements about jobs, about investment, I thought that they had got that theme together. So I was surprised yesterday to see nothing at all from Rishi on that side. And, you know, he's been very cautious, I think, about supporting that side of Boris's agenda. And I think by omitting to mention anything about wanting to decarbonize and part of that being central to the agenda of the government, he's showing quite a division with the direction that Boris is going on. So instead, we had from him, you know, the various announcements which other people have talked about. And I must just observe that I think that Rishi was a phenomenal performer. I mean, he didn't have the difficulties of the baying mob in the chamber, which is usually accompanies that sort of fiscal event. But he still did very well in terms of his temperament, in terms of his presentation. As Stephanie pointed out, there were some nasty things tucked in there, like the universal credit extension of, I can't remember, it's £10 or £20 a week, but still it's fairly significant, not being there from April next year. And that may or may not last. I agree, there may be a kind of rebellion from MPs on that. But he nevertheless managed to deliver a budget without sort of frightening the horses at quite an important time, a spending review, and without talking at all about the two topics of either taxes or Brexit. On international aid, I do agree with Deborah that it's one of those issues where Number 10 have obviously decided that it's a cultural issue in which they want to, you know, wedge a fight between the two different parties, which they think they will do much better at. I think it's a very dangerous game because, you know, she's absolutely right that when you, as a former MP, when you go campaigning, the voters will quite quickly say, charity begins at home, what are you doing spending so much money overseas? But if you're going to knock 0.7% down, why have 0.5%? And I know that on WhatsApp, an MP WhatsApp group last night, there were various Conservative MPs saying, yeah, 0.5% is too high. Why have any at all? So you've opened it up to going down and down. And I don't think that apart from the hit you get today of apparently pleasing certain voters, I don't think it'll last because it's clearly movable and the pressure will be to move it further down. And it is completely untrue for the government and their representatives to say, this is temporary, it'll go right back up to 0.7% very soon. Nobody's putting this back up to 0.7% unless it's a Labour government. So I think it's a great shame. And I also think that it hits again on the whole theme of the UK leading on the green agenda, because one of the key elements of any successful COP deal next year on climate change will be being able to support non-OECD countries to industrialise. And in order to do that, we're going to have to raise a lot of money internationally. And even though the UK is still one of the major donors on international aid, despite this cut, it's still a very difficult signal in which to win the argument to bring others on in order to make COP26 a success. So I think there's a division there between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, which is only going to get worse, and I think was revealed very strongly in the Chancellor's topics yesterday. Finally, if I may, on the 4 billion slush fund, Northern Levelling Up Fund that was announced as part of his spending yesterday. The person who will be really pleased about that is the Chief Whip. This government has proven that MPs can be very rebellious very often, more so than we've seen before. Not if you want your 20 million high street fund expanded, not if you want your 10 million for this or for that. That is going to be a very useful tool for good government as far as the Chief Whip is concerned over the next few years.
That's really fascinating, Amber. What's really interesting here is, like, you know, how politics and economics interact. So I'm sure that will come out in the Q&A. But I'm going to come back to you, Stephanie. I mean, when I worked with you at the BBC, we used to just talk about, you know, astronomical numbers. I mean, this is a completely different level. And we seem to be talking almost as if the rules of economics have been reinvented. Is there anything in that, or is the reality that, you know, that we're just going to have to face some very, very painful times going forward?
You're talking about the magic money tree. I mean, the rules of government borrowing, I think, have been reinvented in the years since the global financial crisis. When you look at what interest rates are now, every year we've said it's record low rates. And a lot of people yesterday picked up on the fact that although we have these extraordinarily high numbers, the highest borrowing in peacetime, the biggest hit to the economy in 300 years and whatever else, our cost of the actual cost of servicing our debt next year is going to be lower than it was in times where we had a fraction of the amount of debt. And that is something, I guess it's intuitive for anyone who's perhaps been remortgaging their house, but it is hard to get your head around quite how cheap this borrowing is. And as long as that continues, the UK is in a particularly strong position. Without going into the technicalities, we have the average maturity of our debt. So this massive debt mountain, which now is equivalent to the size of the economy, the average maturity of that debt is 15 years. So in a sense, we have got ourselves as a nation a long-term fix on most of our debt. So if there is a rise in interest rates, which of course people say we can't assume that we'll have these record low rates, we will be among the last countries to actually feel it, as long as our borrowing is more or less under control in a few years' time. We won't be suddenly facing a big mountain of borrowing costs as a result of that increase in servicing costs, because we have, in effect, locked in extremely good deal that we're getting now on a big chunk of our debt. So I think that sort of should temper if you're a chancellor and you're thinking about the cost benefit of moving faster or slower towards a more sustainable path. You know, that should be a big factor. And I think, as I say, to have the voices of the International Monetary Fund and others saying that I think, is important. And I would just say, just to go back on AMBER, I mean, I was astonished, I should have mentioned it in my thing, I was astonished that there wasn't a big piece for the green agenda in yesterday's speech, given the 10-point plan that we finally had. We've had quite a late, delayed speech from the Prime Minister on that. But for the Treasury not to come in a government where they're supposed to be in lockstep, the Treasury not to be, the other leg to, the other shoe to drop on that 10-point agenda was remarkable. And I'd be fascinated to hear what the internal conversations in the Treasury were. I think £20 a week for the universal credit. She's quite right.
Anthony, you wanted to come in there.
Well, just very quickly to say that on that point that Stephanie was mentioning about relationship between the Treasury and Number 10, that we would be quite wrong to think that the relationship is harmonious, just because, Craig Oliver, you was there at a time of harmony between George Osborne and David Cameron, predicated on the fact that that if he behaved well and nicely, he would succeed. In the last 23 years since Gordon Brown was there, a state of animosity has been the norm, with some truly shocking and dreadful relationships, Blair, Brown, Darling, and May and Hammond being amongst the worst. And the Chancellor has one aim only, and that is to succeed the Prime Minister. And the Prime Minister has to see that off. And this is going to be, we're possibly already into the end game of the Johnson Premiership played out in this symbolic battle that we talked about the role of environmentalism in yesterday's spending review.
So let's explore that, because what I think is interesting is that we often look at the sheer bloody horror of the statistics and the chaos that's going on. And yet, Deborah, you and I both know that Labour should be doing a lot better now if they're really going to succeed. And Amber, I'll bring you in on this point in a moment. They should be streets ahead, shouldn't they? And they're not. So maybe Boris Johnson is onto something here. So Deborah, let's do you and then Amber. You're on mute, Deborah. There you go. Oh, still on mute. There you are.
Can you hear me now?
We can hear you.
Can you hear me?
Good.
I think I unmuted at the same time as somebody else did, so I ended up muting again. Yes, I think that that it's been a very difficult time for Labour, obviously, and it's been hard for a new leader to establish himself against the backdrop of the pandemic and, a kind of different sense of what opposition might be about. Through that time, where it was quite hard in some instances to differentiate, to disagree. I think all things considered, Keir Starmer made quite a good start, but I think things are slowing up for him now at a time when they need to be accelerating, and it's very difficult. And then that obviously has arrived at the same time as yet another internal row about the Labour Party bickering amongst itself and talking about, whenever you hear Jeremy Corbyn mentioned, whenever you hear the NEC in the news, I think that takes, Labour's popularity takes a dent, because who cares, frankly? At a time when people want to know what Labour would do. I mean, the job of leader of the opposition, the job of, Shadow Chancellor, is to show that you would be better at running the country, running the economy, whatever it is, than the incumbent. And I don't think that is being done at the moment. And whilst it's a big ask, I think that Labour should be further ahead in the polls now. And the other, there's a real sense of urgency here, because what we also know is that people make their minds up quite quickly. And then once they have a settled view of a politician, it's really hard to change those views. So I think that window is getting smaller and smaller.
So Amber, you and I look at the situation and can sort of critique it, but are we in danger of critiquing it from a sort of establishment perspective? And actually, in reality, they're much more in tune with the way people are thinking. I mean, I'm thinking about the foreign aid thing here, which is dear to a certain brand of establishment people. But in reality, as Deborah says, the people just don't like it. And they're glad that the slush fund that you talked about exists instead.
Yeah, I mean, that is what it feels like, that the political and cultural moves that Number 10 are making are having some success. But I think that it's, in addition to that, if I may say, I don't think that would be enough on its own. I do think that the lingering tail of Brexit is still having an impact against Labour. I saw that somebody commented on the fact that Labour have said that they are likely to support the Brexit deal, should there be one, whatever it is, which makes me weep for the time that I spent in the Brexit wars when Labour, particularly under Keir, who was, of course, the Brexit secretary, despite the fact that Corbyn kind of wanted a deal, Keir made sure there wasn't a deal that Labour could support, were refusing to participate. So I think that they haven't got any cut through because they haven't got any really oppositional policies. They're going to support Brexit. They're supporting most of the COVID issues. They kind of hit around on the edges. So the only way they're going to really cut through is by having strong personalities. And I think Keir has got that and is succeeding up to a point, but I don't see it with any of his team. I mean, I'm sort of amazed that many of the sort of Labour serious senior MPs who would have, I would have expected to be able to cut through beside him, are either having no impact or they're still running select committees and aren't participating for one reason or another. So I can see they're not cutting through, and I can see that unless they start making a change to that, either with their own team or with finding something to differentiate themselves, they're not going to make any progress.
Stephanie and Anthony, let's pick up on this Brexit point. Brexit seems to be the one word that no politician seems to want to utter. Rishi didn't mention it at all yesterday. The Labour Party definitely doesn't want to talk about it at all. And yet you have the governor of the Bank of England suggesting that it could have a far greater impact if we don't get a deal than coronavirus. From an economic point of view, Stephanie, how worried are you about the Brexit thing, and is it being talked about enough?
I think I wasn't, in a way, I wasn't surprised, apart from potentially announcing a bit of extra sort of precautionary fund or something. I wasn't expecting Rishi to say too much about it yesterday. For what it's worth, and Amber may have a better sense of this, we are being vehemently told that there will be a deal over the next week or so. And actually, it could have happened this week had it not been for the quarantining of various members of the team. I think if we're looking at, albeit this kind of bare bones deal that seems most likely, then some of what Andrew Bailey, Bank of England governor, was talking about goes away. But as we know, there's been most of the hit from Brexit is already in those plans. Even with this deal, you're still looking at potentially 4% hole and in a few years' time going forward into the future as a result of Brexit. But I am a little bit worried, and we've also got our sort of reporters hopefully in the traps to look at this in January and February. I think there will be quite a lot of unexpected consequences of the very hard form of Brexit that we're moving. And once the dust settles, we've talked about this on calls before, but once you have the relief of having a deal, you know, Boris Johnson was right to be nervous about how such a bare bones deal would play out across the country once people saw that it really wasn't much worth shouting about. And I suspect it would be very interesting to see how the economics and politics comes together across the country when sectors who thought they were completely isolated from this, who aren't particularly big exporters, who haven't spent their time thinking about customs regulations, suddenly realise actually their life is being changed and it's quite annoying. And quite a lot of bureaucracy comes from having left the EU. How that plays out, I think, will be quite unpredictable.
And Anthony, I noticed this morning that the European Research Group, which is basically the hardline Brexit MPs in the Conservative Party, were warning Boris Johnson that any deal that threatens sovereignty would be a massive problem, which is obviously pushing him in the direction of no deal, because he's probably going to have to make a compromise if he's going to do a deal. I know you think it's a catastrophe, but how much of a problem do you think this is?
Well, I think it's a deceit, Craig. I think that Brexit was sold to the country on the basis of once we get these terrible people off our backs, the country will again relive the glory days of the 1980s and Big Bang and Margaret Thatcher. And it's a deceit. I think when the deceit impacts, I don't think it is unpredictable. I think it will be a predictable smash back at Boris Johnson. And the question is only how big that will be, which will depend partly on the deal, but only partly on the deal that is negotiated. My other point was just to endorse what everyone's been saying about the Labour front bench. On the other two occasions when Labour has unseated a long-serving Conservative administration, there was formidable talent on the Labour front bench. In 1964, Harold Wilson, possibly the greatest opposition leader in the 20th century, with a superlative team of people like Roy Jenkins and Dennis Healey. And again in 1997, with Tony Blair and Gordon Brown and Derry Irvine and Peter Mandelson and others, who are so far ahead of the caliber and the talent. I would just add to that, though, that Labour under it's still under Starmer is still adjusting to the Corbyn shock, and it may yet. There are real talent there. He hasn't all got the right people and the right jobs yet. They might, over the next 2 and 3 years, surprise us all.
I think it's certainly true. Extraordinary volatility in these times, isn't it? So we don't know where it's going to jump. Question here from Alice Hunt, who's really, I think, talking about expectation management here. So Deborah and you on this. Basically saying it's, to what extent do we think Rishi Sunak was laying the ground for compounding economic impact of Brexit and likely struggles of getting a US trade deal, obviously worries about tax cuts, spending cuts, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of expectation management here. And how do you think that'll play with the public, Deborah?
Yeah, I noticed that question. I think it's interesting. And, you know, there has also been, I think, some comment that he has been overly pessimistic and that, yes, that actually he could be more positive. I think in the end, as Stephanie has suggested, the devil ultimately will be in the detail. People have, in a grand sense, very high expectations of what Brexit can deliver to them. And I think let's assume probably on balance those things won't happen. You know, it won't be the case, as I heard in the Red Wall, that the weaving industry in Lancashire is going to revive because we've Brexited. People up there do think that that is possible, by the way, but I think it probably won't happen. But actually, I think the thing that probably will be much more annoying is the impact on SMEs and businesses that suddenly find that something that they hadn't anticipated is happening to them and that they're having to spend a huge amount of time. And it's something that actually at the moment, and I'll be able to share this in a couple of weeks, Britain thinks we are actually doing some work with small businesses, looking at what they expect, and then we'll be looking at the deal when it appears. Like everybody, I think I'm sort of assuming that there will be one, that it'll be a so-called skinny deal, although that will not be how Boris Johnson describes it. We will be told it is completely fabulous. And for the time being, people will believe that, but the devil will be in the detail down the track.
And Amber, do you think there was a deliberate case of exaggerating quite how bad things are going to be so that maybe when they eventually come, they're not as bad as people expect and the expectations have been managed?
I think there may well have been, and I did think it was ironic the way Rishi spoke about being straight with the British people about the consequences of this borrowing and refused to mention Brexit. He wants to be straight with the British people. He might as well incorporate that. And can I just make a comment too, as Stephanie referred to the skinny deal that we think is going to take place, and that is what I'm hearing as well, so that at least a skinny deal is better than no deal and Boris Johnson can declare victory. But he is in danger just in making sure that the ERG and the Brexiteers support him and declare victory at this end. And I think it's fairly straightforward to observe that Priti Patel could have turned up at work with a whole armoury of weapons and used them to settle some scores with the civil servants, but she was still going to be in place. He needs her to declare victory as well.
Push back a little bit on the might be being pessimistic. I mean, I would say they're not. I mean, remember, some of the key forecasts are from the OBR, not from the Treasury. So in some sense, he doesn't have, thanks to George Osborne, he doesn't have full control over these expectations. But I mean, I would not say that these were pessimistic expectations. And actually, in some key respects, they're quite optimistic. So if you just look at the long-term damage that is expected in the economy by the end of 22, 23, you know, what's the whole, how far are we off where we would have been? That's actually only about 3% of GDP. And I say only, that would be less than any of the past recessions. It's actually assuming that scarring is much less than this recession, in this recession than in others. And you might have reasons to think that, but that could end up being optimistic. We've, in the past, we've often underestimated that. Related to that, the long-term hole in the public finances that he would need to fill, the borrowing that's left when you've done all your COVID spending, is about 100 billion going forward. A lot of people think that number is quite optimistic, especially if they do end up having to reverse on things like the universal credit. So if anything, I would say it would go the other way. Certainly not outlandishly negative figures at all.
And sticking with the optimism point, Stephanie, just can you try and build a picture of where you expect things to be racing ahead next year, which businesses you, sectors you think will be doing well and which ones will be doing poorly? Just do a thumbnail sketch.
No, I think that I think part of the uncertainty around that is another reason why you don't want to start making big pronouncements as a chancellor on which business models are going to have to change and where you're expecting to see job losses. We're obviously going to have a pretty rapid bounce back in areas that have been so completely hammered this year. There is pent-up spending in these things. We may be surprised by how much goes back into some personal services things. But of course, it, the nature of services that it's quite hard to consume twice the amount to sort of catch up. You might be able to buy some more books or do other things, but going to the restaurants twice as much or going to your hairdresser twice as much. I've had this debate with the economist of how many haircuts was he expecting in his, you know, his catch up scenario for the service sector over the next year. So there is it's a little bit harder for the service sector to catch up lost ground than the goods sector, which is another reason why we look worse than countries that are less dependent on the service sector. But I do think there's still enormous uncertainty, and I wouldn't count out aviation. I wouldn't count out all these things whose business model is currently being rewritten by people who maybe are not close enough to it.
Okay, I want to have a look at the social side of it, because one of the major themes that we have on these calls is that business is now expected more than ever to have a purpose and a role in society. I'll come to Deborah and Amber in a moment, but Anthony, just with your historical perspective, we're talking about at least doubling in the size of unemployment. We know the social impact of that. Just talk a little bit about that and how you expect that to play out.
Unemployment is something that is never good for governments, but it all depends how they can play it. And so it will, where is the unemployment, for how long, what parts of the country, how structural, how long term is it? What is the story that the government can tell about the unemployment and about the optimism? What's the journey? So I think it we're not yet clear how much unemployment there's going to be, what is going to be the extra spending associated with that, or indeed what the journey is going to be that the government will describe for it. I do think also, by the way, that the government needs to shove money into SMEs, as I was arguing in a business growth fund booklet last month, urgently, desperately needs equity funding for our SMEs. We need to have more of that structure, the Mittelstand structure of, to mention Germany again, so much we can learn from Germany. But without that, I think we're going to be in trouble and unemployment will be even higher.
Deborah, how much do you think it's going to bite? I mean, we've seen in the past the impact of that, and when people start seeing it, it starts having an effect on public opinion big time.
It will, but I mean, I think I would come back to the point that I made right at the beginning, though, which is that you then have to, what this then depends on is who do people trust to get them out of this. So the worse it gets for people, the worse their experiences, the more they are going to look at the politicians in front of them and say, who do I trust to navigate my way out? I recall I was advising Labour in 1992, in the 1992 election, where, you know, the economy was in a terrible state. And frankly, a lot of people in Labour then thought, great, this is fantastic. It's their fault. We're going to do well. actually what happened was the public looked at what was in front of them and said, you know what, I still trust that lot more to get me out of this. And I suspect that's where we would be again. I mean, I think if the economy does badly, obviously everybody suffers, but politically that will also potentially benefit the Tories as things stand, rather than Labour with a very well trusted and well liked Chancellor up against a shadow Chancellor who nobody knows.
Just while you've got the mic, Deborah, I'm noticing one question. Somebody was asking what animal was Nicola Sturgeon, if you could give a clue.
I saw that. Yeah, okay. Obviously, she was a tiger, wasn't she? She was a tiger. There was another thing that we did, actually, just as a quick aside, in the leadership study, was we gave different scenarios and said, if this leader was managing that scenario, I think the one that we used in the focus group for Nicola Sturgeon was, you are managing a football team and they are down 3-0 and it's half time, what do you do? And they said, she would run out onto the pitch with them and be in there with them. There's this sense of her leadership being very inclusive and very dynamic. She was really, really well admired both sides of the border.
Very interesting. Okay, we're coming towards the end of the call, so I just want to put one thing to all of you, then we'll wrap it up. It feels very uncertain times, both in terms of the coronavirus and in terms of the economy. People are starting to wonder about 2021, what we can expect, what we can see, how optimistic you're feeling about it, that kind of thing. So Amber, difficult question, but start looking forward to 2021. What are you expecting to see? How are you feeling about it?
I'd like to see more on the green agenda, and I think that Boris's 10-point plan indicated that that's where he wants to go. But I expect to see the government begin to seriously panic about the union and the possibility of losing Scotland as part of the union. Deborah's been very clear about Nicola's popularity. We can be equally clear about Boris Johnson's unpopularity north of the border.
Anthony, your expectations for 2021?
Well, obviously we all hope for the best, Craig, but it does no service to anybody not to be honest. Have we got the right Prime Minister? Will he go down in history as the man who led the country to a disaster with Brexit, failed to lead it properly and decisively through COVID, and broke up the union? But I think that equally he could emerge by the end of 2021 as that figure who is going to unify the country. Very few, just to remind listeners, prime ministers have an ism after them. Thatcher did. You don't need to have an overwhelming narrative, and it will be sufficient for him to win in 2024, if indeed Sunak or somebody else hasn't taken over, to have got the country convincingly through COVID and through the economic aftershock of that and through Brexit. I mean, that's a pretty formidable list. I personally would love him to have environmentalism and embracing AI and looking after SMEs in there as well.
Deborah, your predictions for 2021?
Yeah, I mean, I think things are potentially looking very good for Boris Johnson. It's worth remembering what people liked about him when they voted for him. They liked his authenticity, they liked his patriotism, and they liked his optimism. And I think that there is the real potential. I think the problems that come down the track will be further away. There's the potential to play to that optimism. The one thing I agree with Amber is Scotland. I think that's potentially a real problem. And whilst people south of the border, you know, still rate him, they definitely do not north of the border.
Stephanie, so much of this is about trying to invest and build and, you know, get infrastructure projects that, you know, they take years, don't they? I mean, the reality of getting this all off the ground in 2021 seems unlikely. What are your thoughts about it all?
And how we discover about this again and again, what matters most for how people feel and how the economy does is actually what's happening in the rest of the world. We are still a very open economy, despite our efforts to become more closed. And I think we will, the world, I think, will feel a lot better. People personally are going to just feel better because they've stopped feeling bad, that they've stopped, and they've stopped being so massively constrained in their personal capacity to do things. So I guess the question is, what I hope we won't spend next year doing is continuing to wonder why we're not doing as well as other people. but we will definitely get a bounce back in quite a lot of areas that should, I mean, it should benefit Boris, it should benefit the government. But I do suspect we'll still have a puzzle of why we haven't done as well as we should have done, looking at around the world at how others have done.
That's a great place to leave it. I found that a really fascinating call, mainly because I think so much of the thinking and conclusion are really counterintuitive. So it's really fascinating. We'll be in touch with everybody about doing more of these later on. But in the meantime, I'd like everybody to do their usual thing of give the virtual standing ovation to what's been an amazing panel again. Thank you so much for taking time, Stephanie Flanders, Amber Rudd, Deborah Mattinson, and Anthony Seldon. You were all great, and we really appreciate it. Thank you very much.